very large numbers of people that question the war in Afghanistan, question the war in Iraq, and question the intervention in Libya, saying that really, really what those wars are about, demonstrating military power, but also the vast mineral reserves and wealth that's there in Afghanistan to be exploited, the oil reserves that are there in Iraq to be exploited, and the oil reserves that are there in Libya to be exploited. We're in a global race for resources. And a global race means there's winners and losers. If you win, you control, but you have as a price at control, and that price is armed occupation. Surely, we need a much more rational approach to the world. We need to defend and protect our environment for all of us. We need to end the wars and start redistributing wealth rather than grabbing from each other.
Since the onset of the crisis in 2008, I think the cost of the war has become an additional issue which angers people. I think they think, if you're going to reduce my wages and cut my welfare services, what the hell do you think you're doing fighting wars, which in any case I thought were wrong? And I think that's a very, very widely held view. The Trade Union Congress, representing 7 million workers, passed a resolution this year saying that the Afghan war should end, that the Iraq war was wrong, that the Libya intervention was wrong. And that, in addition to the opinion poll evidence, shows that many working people just don't accept the argument for the war and just don't accept the cost of it.
We're being told we're all in this together. Well, we're not all in this together. We're all being told to tighten our belts and be careful about our spending, and yet the government wants us to be supporting businesses. Well, we would support businesses if we didn't have to support the war. The government's always got money for war. It's always got money for warmongering. Why do we interfere in places like Libya? I think the money being spent on war should be put back into our economy. There's plenty of money. There's no need for any of these cuts. Believe you me, I am absolutely certain if the people who should be paying their taxes were paying their taxes, instead of, you know, big businesses, which is what I'm talking about, going off and putting their money in offshore accounts where they're not paying into the UK economy, if we weren't supporting the arms trade, and make no bones about it, I would imagine there's absolutely loads of ministers and people in the cabinet and the government who are paying, who are getting money back, rather, from profits from the arms trade and from war. Why do they give money for warmongering? Why do they support this? Well, they're also cutting the defence budget, I have to say, because they will profit from it, because it suits them. It suits Britain to be in a strategic military position around the world where there's oil, where there's mineral wealth, where there's things that we want.
Child poverty in Britain. Part 2.
This is one of the big scandals of the situation, which is that at the same time as British, many people in Britain and elsewhere are suffering very, very badly from the economic crisis, their lives are getting worse. A time when we're being told that we have to accept cuts to our welfare provision, to the NHS, to social services, to childcare, to all these things. We're also being told that it is essential that we spend billions of pounds on foreign wars, which, by the way, don't have majority support. I mean, the majority of people in Britain want the troops home as fast as possible from Afghanistan. The majority of people oppose the bombing of Libya from the start in Britain. So, you know, it's completely undemocratic. It's being done against the wishes of the majority of the people, but we're told it has to happen. Now, like these two things, that it doesn't really add up. I don't believe that these wars do anything but actually generate misery in Libya and Afghanistan. And so they should stop spending the money on wars, and they should spend it on the things that people really need in a very desperate situation.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, I lived in London for most of my life. I moved to Hastings about 18 months ago, just after I'd had him, just because it's a lot cheaper outside London than it is to live in London. So obviously I had to make, because of the space, and like, and I knew if I lived in outside London, I can get a bigger space for him, and I can, for the amount of money I had at the time. So I had to make that tough decision to move out of London, really. Obviously for me, I know my situation because I have to find a job that evolves around my son, which is difficult. But if I was on my own, I would be working right now. Either starting at 6 in the morning, which I could not do, or they were starting where I'll be finishing at 12, 1 o'clock at night, which I could not do. It's not easy, to be honest, to find a job right now as a single mother.
There are two things that the government really needs to be looking at. That's the situation of families out of work and the situation of families in work. Currently, just over half of children living below the poverty line are in a household where there is at least one parent in work. So low wages, as well as worklessness, is really quite a serious factor underlying our high levels of child poverty. We need a strategy that looks at the growth needed to create the jobs with the decent wages that parents want and that parents need. But we also need to be looking at the deficiencies in the welfare system that are actually going to be worsened by the action of this government with its programme of cuts that has been shown to hit the poorest much harder than the wealthiest. They did say in their austerity programme, everybody is in this together. But in practice, that's not what we're seeing. So they do need to look again at these cuts.
The report that the IFS is actually shocking. It shows that far from the government meeting its promise to tackle child poverty, end child poverty by the year 2020, we're actually going to see a rise in child poverty, a massive rise in child poverty, more than 800,000 more children being in poverty in 2020 compared to this year. And that's simply unacceptable. It means that we're going to see, unless the government takes a drastic change of course, a whole generation of children's life chances lost to the consequences of poverty.
The current government is having to reduce the welfare bill as part of its deficit reduction package. Now, of course, it could have chosen to implement different measures involving less of an impact on the incomes of low-income households and more taxes on the median household. That's the person who's in the middle of the income distribution and against whose income the relative poverty line is set. And that would lead to a reduction in relative poverty. But it is even more difficult to see in such austere times that it would be politically achievable to get the level of increase in redistribution that would be required.
If we haven't got the money to run our health service properly or to build the houses that our people need, and why are we developing a new generation of nuclear missiles, the replacement of Trident, which is going to cost £76 billion? Why are we spending billions of pounds on keeping troops in Afghanistan, keeping troops on alert, and the RAF, the Royal Air Force, on alert over Libya?
Liam Fox's argument that the Libyan invasion or the Libyan operation was so expensive because it was high tech and not liable to kill civilians. I mean, you know, this is a joke on so many different levels, really, because first of all, we were told very early on that the Libyan operation would cost a few hundred million at most. That turns out to be not true. It's going to cost 1.7 billion or something of that order. Secondly, we're told, anyway, this is supposed to be an operation to save civilians. It's a humanitarian operation. And yet, even by Liam Fox's own admission, we clearly are going to be killing and have killed a whole number of civilians in Libya. For us to be spending this amount of money at a time when, as I say, we are also being told that it is essential that we have cutbacks in the public services, cutbacks in the NHS, cutbacks in the education system and so on, it's an outrage, really. No one wants these wars. And, you know, the justification for the wars don't add up anymore, which is why the opinion polls are so strongly against them. It's fundamentally a war about control of the region, about resource grabs, about Western powers and Britain, in most importantly, trying to build their influence or maintain their influence in the Middle East. Why should British people be paying for this kind of corporate war at a time when we're also being told we have to make cutbacks in things that are really essential for us? It's a disgrace. The priorities of the government are all wrong, and we're going to carry on campaigning until they change.
The new government has come in. It has brought in this enormous austerity package, and the first thing it did was to take £40 billion per year away from the welfare budget. That affects families, that affects children, that affects the unemployed. And under the welfare reform bill that they're now trying to push through Parliament, from 2013 there will be a global limit on what a family can get in benefits of £500 per week. Now that sounds a lot of money, sounds fantastic. But when the rent of a private house or flat in this area is £350 per week, that only leaves £150 per week for everything else for a family with children. And that means that the levels of poverty are going to get worse, or poor working class families are going to be driven out of areas like this to live somewhere else. It's not a good situation at all, and I'm very, very angry about it. And I contrast this. I was angry with the Labour government for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the money that was spent on that. And I'm equally angry with this government for now proposing the replacement of the nuclear missile system by spending £76 billion on new nuclear missiles. This is ridiculous.
Evident from a child's point of view, but looking back and in hindsight, I can only imagine the struggle and the plight of someone like my mother, a single parent trying to raise four young people in the economic climate that we've seen in the last 10 years. It must have been an extreme struggle, but it's something that, you know, I look back with fond memories nonetheless, which is a testament of how well she's done.
There is a big gap between rich people and poor people in my area, and I think in all London and UK. And it's very hard to get job because the background, because the learning, the language sometimes, the hijab sometimes. So many challenges. So to improve your level of life, you need to work hard, double than any other person. So poor, they kept poor, maybe, especially if they already are coming from different background and languages. And we don't have that chances like any other, like people learning or English their first languages.
I can imagine that the life must have been very hard for parents like my mother to raise young people or young children in times where the food prices are the highest in Europe. And travel is through the roof. Life must have been very hard. And obviously as a child, that is kept away from you and you don't really understand. But, you know, I think that one thing that I can easily say, you know, money wasn't a luxury for us and for me. And not to say that, you know, I feel in any way hindered by that. But I feel that was something that, you know, is definitely an issue and did prevent me from doing things that other young people were able to do.
In Britain, we measure both absolute poverty and relative poverty. The idea of absolute poverty is an income line that is held constant so that over time, if the national wealth is increasing, you should see the numbers of children in absolute poverty falling substantially. Relative poverty looks at the difference between the richest and the poorest, And that's really quite important, because if you don't make progress on relative poverty, you end up with a situation of social segregation where the richest and the poorest are living quite separate, different lives from each other. And that can lead to all kinds of social problems in society.
It's really important that in terms of government policy, the government looks at its ambition to make work a route out of poverty. It's actually carrying out some radical reform of the welfare system in Britain. It wants to be able to guarantee that if people take jobs, they will be definitely better off than being on benefits, and that's a good thing. But unfortunately, the investment that's being put into the welfare system is not enough to guarantee that parents who are in work will be able to earn enough to raise a family. It's vital that the government supports more help for parents on their childcare costs, more help for parents who want to go back to work, more help for parents who want to work part-time, so that children are being able to be given the things they need by their parents who are in work.
I do think the government can do more to help single mothers, especially those who do want to go back to work and those who do want to better themselves. I think they should put more focus on that. Been looking for a job for the last 6 months at least. And I mean, as I said, I have got job offers, but the hours are not child friendly. And, you know, so I can't accept those jobs. So that's why it has taken me a lot longer to find a job.
At the moment, we're in a situation where the big banks, which are essentially responsible for the economic mess that we're all in right now, are being bailed out by the government with taxpayers' money to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds, not just in Britain, but right across the world. And yet, we have a situation where, you know, these kids, these young people, are suffering serious levels of poverty on a scale that hasn't really been the case for many, many years in Britain. And they're just allowed to, it's allowed to carry on. The scandal continues. And really what the government should be doing is changing its priorities drastically. The austerity policies that they're pursuing are making the economic crisis worse anyway, are leading potentially to a double-dip recession. What should be happening is the government should be responding to this crisis by actually giving money and resources to those who are suffering most from it, and that includes young people, it includes kids. So there needs to be a real shift in the priorities of the way the government is going.
We've been in an unwinnable war in Afghanistan, and we've spent £18 billion on it. We have a Trident missile system which costs £75 billion, which is a leftover from the Cold War, the Trident missile system. That's where it originated. So the weapon is aimed at absolutely nobody. Nobody seriously thinks there's going to be a nuclear exchange between superpowers now. Everybody knows that the Russian state is not going to launch a preemptive nuclear missile attack on London. So you have an entirely redundant nuclear weapons system costing billions of pounds, which is simply a virility symbol for the British government. So these are viewed, these weapon systems and the conflicts are viewed in two totally polarised and opposed ways by the mass of the population in this country and by the government. And I believe it's only really a campaign of political disobedience and protest that will force the government to relinquish spending on these items. It has to become too painful politically to continue down this road before the government will give it up.
Obviously, people would be, you know, when they find out, people are very, very angry. I mean, we're talking around 1.7 billion for Libya. We're talking 4 to 4.5 billion a year on the occupation of Afghanistan and rising. We're talking about 70, 80, 90 billion pounds, depending on how you calculate it, on Trident. If you add all that together, you're talking about enough money to get rid of at least a third of the deficit that we're being told is the cause of austerity in the first place. So, yeah, I think these figures are explosive figures. But I think people are angry anyway. I mean, the fact is, I think people are aware that wars cost a lot of money. And, you know, you look at all the opinion polls, they show that the majority of people want these wars to end and they don't want other wars to start. So, I mean, public opinion is actually on the side of the peacemakers. Public opinion is against the warmongers. And that's one of the things that is so outrageous about the situation at the moment. Both in terms of the austerity measures and in terms of the wars they're fighting, the politicians in their Westminster bubble are way out of touch with the popular mood and popular opinion. And that's, again, one of the things that we have to overcome. We have to overcome this democratic deficit that is really plaguing this country badly now.
What about Bahrain and other places? Are we interfering there? Are we going there and supporting those people who are under, you know, military regimes and it's awful human rights? Look at our own human rights. We don't have a very good record of human rights with all the sort of flights of rendition and people like Shaka Armour still sitting around. You know, where's Obama and Cameron in terms of stopping all this disgraceful stuff around the war? It's about time we pulled out of all these places and got our own house in order before we started interfering around the world and bring our money back in-house as well. You know, because if we were to actually save the billions of pounds that's being spent at the moment on the wars around the world, and I think something like 40 billion quid or more, I'm not sure the exact figure right now, on Libya, on the interference in Libya. The Libyan people should have been left to deal with things themselves.
This government has come in and done the opposite. It's now said all the debts are going to be paid off in 3 years, and that they will not continue the rising of benefits at the rate even of the retail price index, but only of the consumer price index, and that they will cut money on education, health and local authorities who provide an awful lot of the primary services that many of the poorest people rely on. The cuts are hitting disproportionately at the poorest, disproportionately at the most vulnerable, and making millionaires out of those people that pay very little in tax or go through a process of tax avoidance. What we're seeing is a growing gap between the richest and the poorest within our society. What we're seeing is growing poverty amongst the children in this country. It is unnecessary and it is wrong. The way out of a recession is to invest in the future. Invest in new houses, invest in new railways, invest in new infrastructure, invest in jobs for the future. We're already at between 8 and 10% national unemployment in this country. We're at 23% underemployment or not economically active in this country, and we have more than 20% of our young people without work, and it's going to get worse. This is not the way out. The way out is to invest in the future, not destroy the life chances of this generation.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. Osman ibn Hunayf was the governor of Basra. He was a very good man and loved Imam Ali alayhi salam very much. His love for Imam Ali alayhi salam was to an extent that he was even tortured when the enemies attacked Basra. The enemy forces pleated his beard from his face. When he went to Imam Ali alayhi salam, his face was bleeding because of the torture. Once, Osman ibn Hunayf was invited by a rich man to a party, and he attended the party. Upon hearing this, Imam Ali alayhi salam wrote a letter to Osman ibn Hunayf and criticized him. The letter is available in Nahjul Balagha as letter number 45. In this letter, Imam Ali alayhi salam wrote to Osman ibn Hunayf, "O Osman, I'm your Imam. I eat the simplest food and wear the simplest clothes. However, I don't order you to wear like me or eat like me. My only advice for you is to help me with your righteous action. This is my only advice." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Hello.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
This suffering is on the U.S. government, said Code Pink. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Unfreeze Afghan Funds Demanded After 13,000 Newborns Die from Malnutrition. Stay tuned for more. Human rights advocates are demanding that the United States immediately release billions of dollars which it seized from Afghanistan's central bank after ending its 20-year military occupation of the country last year, causing a devastating hunger crisis that has already killed thousands of Afghan newborns in 2022. With 95% of the country unable to access sufficient food due to the currency crisis, Human Rights Watch, HRW, reported last week that 13,000 newborn babies have died of malnutrition and hunger-related diseases since January, warning that time is running out to address hunger in the impoverished country. This suffering is on the U.S. government, said anti-war group Code Pink recently, in response to reports that as many as 3.5 million Afghan children need urgent nutrition support. After spending months sitting on more than $9 billion it seized from the central bank last summer, after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the Biden administration last month announced it would commit $3.5 billion to unspecified humanitarian efforts. But as HRW reported last week, the U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country, while currency shortages are forcing Afghan banks to limit withdrawals. Birgit Schwartz, a communications manager for the organization, said the country needs a functioning central bank. Aid is not enough. As Ryan Cooper wrote at the American Prospect last month, the seizure of Afghan funds has caused all the problems one might expect. The banking system has ceased to function, he wrote. Businesses can't find credit and have resorted to mass bankruptcies and layoffs. People can't get enough cash. The country can't afford necessary imports, and the value of the currency is collapsing. Code Pink noted that the Biden administration's decision to split the funds it seized last year, reserving $3.5 billion for families who lost loved ones on September 11, over the objections of many of those family members, undoubtedly exacerbated this horrific crisis. According to a report, hospitals run by charities like Doctors Without Borders or MSF have become completely overwhelmed. One in every five children admitted to critical care is dying, wrote Yugita Liami, and adding, the situation at the hospital has been made worse in recent weeks by the spread of the highly contagious Mycelis disease that damages the body's immune system, a deadly blow for the babies already suffering from malnutrition. While the director of one humanitarian group told HRW last week, children across the country are only skin on bones now, Cooper noted that there is likely enough food in Afghanistan for all Afghans to survive, and in any case, more could be imported as needed. The main problem is the shattering recession and currency crisis that has crushed the Afghan economy since American troops withdrew, he wrote. Occupation spending accounted for about 40% of the country's GDP and three-quarters of its government budget. Most Afghans can't afford food that would otherwise be readily available. The country's hunger crisis is absolutely heartbreaking, as well as preventable, said MSNBC journalist Mehdi Hassan. According to Sarah Sirota of The Intercept, lawmakers, including Senators Chris Murphy and Jeff Merkley, are calling on the Biden administration to move more quickly to try to loosen up the banking system. Murphy recently said, "We absolutely could be moving more money more quickly."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me on.
Our pleasure. Well, we are going to talk about the jurisprudential laws, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, related to prayer. And let me start our episode with this question, Sheikh Javid. What are the things, the elements that make a prayer void?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are as many as 12 invalidating agents. And this is a matter of consensus among the religious authorities. All the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that if one of those 12 things, one of those 12 requirements are not fulfilled, then the prayer is definitely affected. Mm-hmm. For example, if your cloth is usurped, or if the place where you offer your prayer is najis, or when maybe the land on which you offer your prayer is usurped, it's not your property, and you offer your prayers on that piece of land mm-hmm. without the permission or the consent of its owner, then your prayer is void. This is one of the conditions, and of course the first condition. And then we have the second condition, and the second invalidating agent. Instead of saying condition, I would say invalidating agent, the mm-hmm. second thing which makes the prayer void. And that's when someone, let's say, discharges urine, for example. If a person, discharges urine or anything, like, for example, someone cannot control his bowel, or, for example, he passes wind, or... And he discharges urine, let's say voluntarily or involuntarily, mm-hmm. then obviously he cannot offer prayer with the najasa or the essential impurity. So he must wash himself and must take a quick action to wash himself and make himself prayer.
Yes.
And make himself pure. And it does not make any difference whether it is his body that is impure or it is, for example, his clothes that is impure. Mm-hmm. In either case, he must wash and he must, there is nothing to purify it except water,
Yes.
You cannot purify yourself. For example, you cannot purify the urinary organ with anything like a piece of stone or a piece of clay or a piece of tissue paper.
Which is normally the case in the...
In the Western toilet, there is, for example, the tissue paper is available.
And of course, you cannot purify your urinary organ with a piece of tissue. Okay, like for example, when it comes to the rectum or the, for example, the back passage. Okay, the scholars have said that if you use three pieces of stone, okay, to remove the, for example, the feces or the najasa. In such a way that there is no substance left, no substance is left, and you are certain that there is no substance left. That is enough. Three pieces of stone, three pieces of things that can remove
the dirt.
Yes, that's enough. But as far as the urinary organ is concerned, there is no way to purify it except using water and washing it. Okay, that is.
What about the emergency situation? Like you are, for example, you have no access to water, you are in the desert or something, you know? What happens there?
Okay, in the said case, you should offer your prayer. And then, again, you have to repeat it because you cannot miss your prayer under any circumstances.
Because I'm asking this question because normally in the laws we see there is some kind of, a substitute for that law, you know, yes, available, like for emergency situations. Yes, for example, when you have no access to water to make wuzu, you can still have tayammum, right?
Yeah, tayammum is something.
Yes.
You know, but the urinary organ must be washed even if you are going to do tayammum. For example, if water is harmful to your body, you, for example, you have your hands plastered maybe you are, bandaged and you cannot remove the bandage or the splint, okay? In that case, there you have to either use jabira or tayammum, okay?
Right.
And it depends from one situation to another.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules or the jurisprudential laws related to prayer. And Sheikh Javid, before the break, you were talking about the invalidating agents for the prayer. Would you please continue?
Well, I was talking about the invalidating agents. I would now touch on the third invalidating agent. The third invalidating agent is to fold your hand during prayer. If a person folds his hands as a mark of humility or to show submission or reverence, his prayers will become white, and there is no doubt about it. But if someone is under taqiyya, you know, he's exercising quietism or dissimulation. He lives in a country where, for example, he is afraid of losing his job or reputation or maybe his life. Okay, he is under threat, and he's exercising taqiyya, which is why he is actually folding his hand. In that case, he can do so. He can fold his hand, and his prayer will be valid according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. But in the state of, for example, no fear, when you are not afraid of anything, and when there's absolute freedom of religious practice, you have no right to exercise taqiyya. You must not fold your hand, and then you should keep your hands on both sides of your on your sides, and practice your religion in the same way as prescribed by the religious scholars and as said by the religious authorities. So folding hand is absolutely forbidden, and it makes the prayer void.
I see. Are there any other invalidating agents?
Yeah, there is a. Yeah, we will continue to count and enumerate the invalidating agent. The fourth thing which invalidates prayer is to say Amin. And of course, we know that the Sunnis, they say Amin, they fold their hands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Amin is not permissible to say after Surah Al-Hamd, because the Sunnis, they say Amin when, for example, the Surah of Al-Hamd is recited, and when Waladhalin is said, then everyone in the congregational prayer is actually recites Amin, and that is not permissible. This rule, when applied to one praying individually, is based on ihtiyat, you know, this is based on. But if someone utters it believing that it has been ordained by Sharia, of course it's haram, because it's not a part of Sharia, and the Sharia has not, the Quran and the lawgiver, the Sharia, has not ordained it, has not legislated, and has not prescribed it. And therefore, if a person deliberately recites it as a part of prayer,
mm-hmm.
which of course it's not a part of prayer, then the prayer will become void. And of course, if a person, because of mistake or because of forgetfulness or mm-hmm. because of he recites Amen erroneously, okay,
right,
then of course his prayer is not affected.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
And there is we have more conditions. The fifth condition which invalidates prayers is to turn away from Qibla, of course, mm-hmm. without any excuse, okay? And of course, if there is an excuse, like for example, forgetting, or for example, an external force, like a strong wind, okay?
Uh-huh. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chawit, for your nice elaboration of the invalidating agents for the prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malja ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basirun
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.